Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect has had Simon Black engaged to do a report on the action at the G20 in Toronto. Simon has had other commitments and has had to delay that till next week. We thought in the meantime we'd play you Simon's interview about the future of violence as related to the G20 and other economic inequity, as he broadcast the last time we spoke to him after the London G20 meetings. Disrespect welcomes Simon Black, researcher at York University and the City University of New York, and a visiting Fulbright Fellow at the City University of New York. Simon, welcome.
Great, Jeff. Thanks. Glad to be back.
You offered to talk about the G20 meeting and the riots that occurred there, including the death of one man who apparently wasn't even involved.
Yeah, he was just walking home from work and got caught up in the melee. The Guardian newspaper, which is available online at guardian.co.uk, has done some great coverage of this, not only the death of that particular man.
Where's the video? Is it Guardian?
It's online. You can get it online at the Guardian's website.
All right.
And that video was released maybe a week or 2 weeks ago, and they've since released a series of videos that were posted today on their website that have documented different incidences of police brutality during the G20 protests, so that one incident wasn't isolated.
It seems to be a kind of class warfare there. I mean, the police here get various instructions, go easy, get those effing Indians out of the park, and they seem to follow instructions for the most part. But in Britain, there seems to be no love lost.
No, there doesn't seem to be. And anyone who's old enough to remember the miners' strikes of 1984, 85...
Yeah.
We'll know that the police were basically given carte blanche by not only the government and the government of Margaret Thatcher, but also by the special services, MI5, I don't know which one. One of them does foreign, one of them does domestic, MI5 and MI6.
Right.
Was involved in not only what they call when protesters are actually sent in to provoke, who are posing as protesters, agent provocateurs.
So one of those agencies provided agent provocateurs?
Right, amongst the striking miners.
Oh, no.
And a lot of the unrest that came from the mining dispute, was not only sparked just by the confrontation between the police and the miners standing up against the closure of the pits that Thatcher was so intent on carrying out, but also the agent provocateurs being... infiltrating the miners' ranks, and it was kept hush, of course. And a couple of good journalists, I think one worked for The Independent and one for The Guardian, which I previously mentioned, unearthed it in the kind of mid-90s or so. Very little was done, though, to crack down on the agencies involved and the police involved. But this sort of thing then, and the treatment of protesters and the response to the unrest at the G20, is not unusual for the British police.
Is there any indication of agent provocateurs at the G20?
I'm sure there's something, protesters blogging or writing on independent media websites will claim that there has been, and I don't doubt that there were, but nothing's been proven thus far.
But the culmination of it is this police vindictiveness towards a man who was doing absolutely nothing with the riot, but trying to get around it and home for dinner.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And with the wave of unrest, it's spreading throughout the world, whether it's in the industrialized North or the global South.
Yeah.
Police tactics are going to be called into question, as they should be, because there's going to be a lot of very angry people, as there already are. But the, you know, the ranks of the unemployed are going to continue to grow as we fall deeper into this recession and possibly depression. So the police tactics are definitely going to be in question.
Brazil and China aside, the commentary that I'm seeing is that the third world is likely to be slower coming out of it, too, than the developed world. And the developed world still hasn't seen the light at the end of the tunnel.
Right. I mean, a lot of people in the developed world and, you know, economists who are familiar with the developed world will say that they've been in crisis for generations now.
Yeah.
This is nothing new. But there are going to be a tremendous amount of jobs lost in places that that export to the north as demand goes down, consumer demand declines.
Yeah.
As we enter recession in the north, you know, demand for goods produced in places like China and Brazil and Mexico will go down, and you'll see layoffs across the global south and across a number of sectors.
Brazil and China are trying to make moves to stimulate domestic consumption. I don't know. China's probably going to be more successful there because they're population-based than Brazil with their dependence on commodity exports.
Right.
I saw some disturbing news about India getting deeper into it in the paper just the other day, and didn't have time to read it. But I just thought, oh, no, you know, India is one of the bright lights, too.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the important thing for your listeners and anybody who's really trying to think through what's happening in the economy and people's response to it is to provide the necessary historical context. We really have to look back to around at least 1973.
Okay.
To see the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile and his socialist regime there.
Yeah.
And the with the help of the CIA, General Pinochet coming to power, and that's when you really have a clear break between the way economies and the way societies were organized prior to that and the way they've been organized since, which has gone under the name of neoliberalism, that kind of political and economic project that's been intent on cutting back social services, combating trade unions. It's led to increasing inequality and poverty across the world, not only in the North.
Quote, disappearances, unquote. Was there any South American country that was untouched by the policy of making people who the state did not favor disappear?
No. Well, the only exception might be Cuba.
Yeah.
But the resistance that people mounted towards this shift in the economies and politics towards neoliberalism.
Yeah.
Neoliberalism, by its very definition, freeing up the markets, but as a great academic and a British academic, Stuart Hall, once said, the markets are to be free, but the people are to be disciplined under neoliberalism.
Yeah.
And that's what you saw across Latin America. You saw the markets being freed up. This is a deregulation of the financial markets, of the labor market, etc. But you saw the people were disciplined, and often disciplined very, very brutally. And as they have been disciplined in Canada as well, trade unions have lost their collective bargaining rights in many ways. The recent attempt by the Harper government, prior to the threat of the coalition toppling him, to restrict the rights of public sector workers to go on strike is just a further example of how neoliberalism hasn't left the workers of the North untouched.
No, and supported to varying degrees by American-based multinationals, both at home and more recognizably abroad. I'm thinking of Coca-Cola now, but there are other examples as well.
Oh, yeah. There's many multinationals, whether they're operating in Nigeria or like Coca-Cola, who are in Colombia and have been found to be hiring death squads to take care of, as they say, their trade unionists who are organizing their factories. There's been no shortage of brutality by multinational corporations who are intent on maximizing profits and minimizing any resistance towards that goal.
How do you see the G20 riots fitting into this? There does seem to be a real divide in British society, and it doesn't seem to be. There seems to be no effort to bring the two sides together. I say two sides because they're not officially two sides, but they're very clearly two sides. When the police look at the opportunity presented by a man whose back is turned as an opportunity to do violence to someone, regardless of what their own actions are.
I think that will spark further interest by people who may not have been sympathetic to the protesters' demand in the first place. The fact that
someone
who wasn't involved in the protest actually, was subject to police brutality.
Yeah, you might not sympathize with the protesters. Better watch your way on the way home from work, sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There was a really interesting report that came out by the head of the Metropolitan London Police, which warned that of a wave of protest and civil unrest in Britain that would spread into the middle classes, not just amongst workers and the poor, but amongst people who previously would not be involved in street protests.
And this was a police administrator?
This was a police administrator, and the report was covered in the British press, more so in the kind of left liberal press like The Guardian and The Independent and The Daily Mirror than in the right-wing press.
Yeah.
And he was very clear that if this crisis continues to unfold the way it seems to be, and if governments aren't quick to respond to it in a way that will shore up jobs and incomes amongst the great majority of the population, that there is going to be unrest, and that unrest will spread into social classes who previously would not think of engaging in street protests or strikes or what have you. A similar report came out of the IMF itself, which is the current chief of the IMF, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, also made a clear statement around the time of the G20 meeting that if governments don't respond appropriately, there is going to be unrest and there will be mass unrest. And he should know, because riots in the global south have occurred throughout the 1990s against IMF policies, and very little reporting has been done on them. At least amongst the Western media.
Yeah. And now for about 3 minutes of Albert Ammons, The Boogie Rocks. Thank you. You've been listening to Simon Black, a researcher at York University and the City University of New York, and a visiting Fulbright Fellow at the City University of New York. Simon talks to us about the future of violence, given the persistence of economic inequity in Western democratic society.
Yeah, well, these are, to my mind, these are people who are not used to being without power. And the idea, the recognition that they may be being deprived of power, even as they are deprived of the supports they count on, their income, their family, their the goodwill of their communities, might lead them to think that their traditional courses of action, such as showing up at the voting booth, are not enough anymore. And that doesn't bode well for Western democracy.
In what way, though?
Well, if you think you have power, you're middle class, right, and you see your income under attack, but you're fighting it, and you're fighting a holding action, you're not winning, but you're slowing down, the government's eating into your income and so forth, and all of a sudden your job is gone, and the government effectively is saying, gee, I don't know what we can do for you, but, you know, we got big bucks for the car makers and the banks, but for you, you know, I think you better get in line. Then, you know, you suddenly you see yourself disenfranchised from society. It's not a position you're used to seeing. And your response to it normally would be to return to the voting booth. But are you going to wait another 2, 3, 4 years before you have your say?
Right.
And you feel yourself unjustly disenfranchised, too. It's not as if you say, oh, well, I bought into this system. I knew this day could come, you know, so I don't have a family anymore. So I don't have a car or a job anymore. So I don't know where my next meal or shelter is going to come from 6 months from now. You know, that's fair. I bought into it. I can't see that happening. You know, I don't see it at all. And I don't see them waiting to show up at the voting booth. And I don't see them writing letters to their MPs either. You know, it looks pretty grim from this point of view, from my point of view.
I think it could go two ways. You could get people who are a mass of people who are alienated from the political and economic system, or like you had in the 1930s in the U.S. I'll just use the U.S. because that's, you know, I'm speaking from New York, and I'm seeing some of the actions that are taking place in New York City right now. You could have a reinvigoration of democracy in the sense that
grassroots
democracy, not just the type of democracy that the people in power like to keep us to, which is, like you said, showing up at the voting booth, and in the United States you vote for two parties of big business, one red and one blue.
Right.
And if you have that reinvigoration of democracy, and I think there's signs that you're going to see that, because you have the return of the sit-down strikes, which were so common in the 1930s, where this is where trade unions were first recognized by the government, and they recognized their right to collectively bargain for their members. And the great sit-down strikes in Flint, Michigan,
oh, yeah,
in 1936 with General Motors,
oh,
which led to the establishment of the recognition of the UAW.
Oh.
And you fast forward to 2008 in December, you're seeing workers at the Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago sitting down at their plant and refusing to leave until they're paid their appropriate severance and vacation pay.
Did it work?
And it worked. Good. In the 1930s, you had rent strikes where people who could no longer afford to pay their rent because of the Great Depression, they were unemployed, would not pay their rent, stay in their homes, and when the police came around to evict them,
yep,
you would see a spontaneous eruption on the streets, and people would come out of their homes to defend the evicted family. Often you had Socialist Party and Communist Party cadres who were involved in doing this, and they would put themselves on the outer circle, so they would absorb the first blows from the police to try to evict the family.
Really?
And now today, again, fast forward to 2008, 2009, and you have groups like ACORN, which is a community organization across the United States and very active in New York City. They're currently carrying out a campaign which is preventing sheriffs from evicting people from homes that have been foreclosed.
Really?
Yeah.
How are they achieving that? Just with numbers?
A lot of this goes under the radar. It's it's called the Home Savers. I think it's called the Home Savers Campaign or Home Defenders Campaign. Sorry.
There does seem to be a, I hate to use the word conspiracy, there does seem to be an acceptance by the media that if they don't broadcast the success of deprived or oppressed people, that there's likely to be less success and more order in society. And I find that disturbing in something that we call a free press.
Right. Well, as you and I know, Jeff, this sort of information is dangerous stuff. And it's not exactly the thing that Rupert Murdoch wants to be putting on his front pages, that people defending their homes from foreclosure and
right.
beating back the sheriffs in New York City. Yeah. Or the homeless who are, you know, I had a statistic today I came across. There's currently 15,000 children in New York's homeless shelters.
No.
There's an organization called Picture the Homeless.
Really?
Which has been very active in taking over abandoned buildings and lots across New York City.
Really?
And occupying them and claiming them.
And successful.
And successful in the sense that in times of crisis, the police do show up. There's more people mobilized, but there's also public opinion shifting.
Yeah.
And if those in power, whether it be in the institutions of the police or in government or what have you, with the justice system, if those in power feel that the tide has shifted in public opinion, they're going to be more reticent to carry out the sort of acts that they would in times of relative prosperity for the rest of the population.
Yeah, it's one thing to tackle a group of 150 people that nobody identifies with. It's another thing to tackle 1,500 people that everybody identifies with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A great illustration. There was an amazing poll that came out by a well-respected public opinion pollster, the Ramison Report, which is relied upon quite heavily in the Beltway in Washington for reliable kind of public opinion surveys. There's a survey that came out last week that said only 53% of Americans felt that capitalism was a better system than socialism, and 20% preferred socialism. Under 30 year olds said 37% favored capitalism and 33% socialism.
That's what I heard. There's a demographic shift there.
This is very unusual.
In the States.
And, you probably haven't seen numbers like this since the 1930s.
Yeah.
When the Progressive Party and the Communist Party and the Democrats under FDR had mass support.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and they were the right-wing edge of this kind of support, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. FDR and Democrats definitely were.
Yeah.
The statistics, it's funny, with Obama in power,
yep.
the statistics amongst Democrats that you saw in this poll was you had 30% of them favoring socialism, with only 39% of them favoring capitalism.
So I know what does that mean? They're undecided? They're undecided, or they're voting for the status quo, or what?
Well, the rest are undecided.
Holy shoot.
20-odd percent, so...
Yeah, well, if you've got 30-some-odd and 30-some-odd, you probably have 30-odd percent undecided in the middle.
Right.
Which is a huge number, and, a threat to the two-party system, too.
It definitely is.
Yeah. I guess bigger than anything we've seen, bigger than, for instance, Ross Perot or Ralph Nader have presented to date. Well, it's good news. I mean, that a different kind of democracy, it could be the outcome of people feeling disenfranchised and not wanting to accept the limited choices that they're given. I mean, it's certainly better than chaos, and maybe we'll begin to see an emergence of this. I mean, we already see a little bit of it in Canada with Stephen Harper pulling his party with their heels firmly dug in to the center, and he's by no means the Canadian concept of center, but he's a conservative, small c conservative concept of center for sure. And
yeah.
if he moves center, I wonder what will be left for the traditional left. There has to be a new kind of initiative to capture votes from left-leaning voters then.
It'll be interesting, definitely, to see where Michael Ignatieff takes the Liberals in a time of economic crisis.
Support.
I know that traditionally the NDP, when you have periods of high unemployment,
yep.
when you have periods of general crisis, will shift to the left, not only because its leadership recognizes that's maybe where it should be,
yeah.
But because the grassroots members of the NDP will raise a stink and make sure that those policies that address the crisis the way it should be addressed will filter up through the party into the leadership.
At the NDP?
Yes, yeah. And even the Liberals, I think progressive and left-wing Liberals will probably be pushing within that party, because Ignatieff so far hasn't shown much in the way of a progressive politics.
No.
And
he strikes me as a liberal of the right.
Coalition.
Yeah. But I wonder if Canadians, I don't know if other Canadians are getting cynical about politicians, so-called centrist politicians, changing their stripes in a new electoral environment. I don't buy it. I don't know how much credibility there is for someone who appears to be pro-business, pro-trade like Ignatieff for setting up an image for himself. Certainly now is the time if he's going to try and do it. And he made a big splash today in the papers about reforming EI and making it accessible to the same degree all across Canada for every province, which it's not in Ontario. Ontarians have less access to EI than they do in the other provinces. And that kind of move, he'll have to make many of those kinds of moves to change his image with the voters. And particularly with Ontario voters who've seen a lot of hot air, but are still saddled with a decidedly right-wing Liberal government, you know, and are getting awful tired of the talking, is the impression I'm getting. There's a lot of, you know, the talk in the beginning about broken promises, and now the talk about no promises, and things still trucking along the same old way, and nothing being done, is the viewpoint that I keep distilling from the newspaper articles that I read on public opinion of the McGuinty Liberals. So with that in mind, I can't imagine that their view of the federal Liberals is going to be helped or will help the federal Liberal chances. And when it dawns on them that the campaigners and the strategists are the same people for in large part, if somebody were to let that loose in well-read media or well-heard media, then it would be even tougher for someone like Ignatieff. And yet, as you say, the NDP, I don't know, you know, they shift further left, they cede more ground to the center, too.
They could do. It could be a consequence, but it depends where the populace goes as well.
Yeah,
if the populace
right.
moves to the left, then you can cede that center ground and not have to worry about it in terms of your electoral calculations. But as I see it, we've got a far ways to go yet before we have the type of mass mobilization that's going to be necessary to challenge the direction that economic elites and political elites want to take us in terms of a response to this crisis.
You want to put that in 10 words or less for me? As you see it, what was that?
As I see it, that we have quite a ways to go before we reach the point of mass mobilization where economic and political elites are going to respond to the crisis in a way that's going to address the concerns of the mass majority of people.
Do they ever, Simon? Do the economic and political elites ever respond to the masses? A good point.
Only when they're forced to.
All right. Okay. Reach the strong arm through the microphone, right, and give them the half Nelson. All right. Thanks for taking time to be with us at CFMU today and to talk to us about what the recent conflict at the G20 represents on a worldwide and a local basis.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
All right. Much appreciated.
Hey, take care.
Bye-bye.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the full articles that we read for you, but these are condensations of the articles from the papers that we mention in the broadcast. First up, you know today is the day that the HST is first levied. This by Jim Coyle in The Star. You'd have to think the government is a little twitchy about the uproar. The government rolled out the Big Bertha of communications howitzers, the technical briefing by senior officials. There was the augmenting of models and the supplementing of analysis and the mapping of spending profiles onto the 5.3 million households. Not to mention multivariate regression, which, trust us kids, is probably something you don't want to mention to your parents, unless you can stand a month-long grounding. After all this, what this astonishing exercise did was produce a collection of charts. But the main problem is that holding a technical briefing in a political war is like bringing a calculator to a knife fight. What the government failed to do was have the minister instantly available to apply appropriate rhetorical framing. Which is to say, dumb it down for the scribbling classes and wrap it all up in pithy partisan packaging. This oversight left reporters to wander out of the technical briefing rubbing their aching heads to where NDP leader Andrea Horvath was doing a little freelance economics of her own. They're saying that 90% of all the savings of HST for companies are going to be passed on to consumers, she declared. That is absolutely not going to happen. The LCBO is not even going to do that, so why would private sector business do that? You know what? If numbers like this were peddled on Wall Street, somebody would end up in jail. And probably vastly more people will remember a line about folks going to jail than anything else about the McGuinty analysis. And under little-known facts about the G20 conference, from the Globe, this by Kate Allen. The government expands police powers. The government of Ontario quietly designated the entire G20 security zone as a public work. The move means anyone entering or even approaching a designated area can be searched without a warrant. The Act usually covers highways and canals used for the transmission of power and other public utilities which are permanently designated. The temporary designation went into effect June 21st and will be rescinded the day after the summit ends on June 28th. It's a very clever way to expand police powers, said Natalie Desrosiers of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. The CCLA believes this is the first time an area has been designated temporarily. The move was passed June the 2nd and only appeared on eLaws June the 16th. It won't be published in the regular paper format until July 3rd, after the summits are over. Greece still having its own problems with strikes. This from the Globe and Mail again. Gina Calaverna and Lefteris Papademos in Athens. Anti-austerity strikes hit tourists at Greece's largest port. Unionists block travelers from boarding ships at Greece's largest port, stranding tourist ferries as part of protests against austerity measures in the debt-choked nation a week ago Wednesday. Tourist bookings are already down after strikes and sometimes violent protests against wage cuts, pension and labor reforms the socialist government is implementing in exchange for €110 billion EU IMF bailout package. There are no ships leaving Piraeus port, a Coast Guard official said. Union members block the boarding ramps of the ferries and plan to keep up their protest until midnight when the engineers' strike ends. Protesters blame the crisis on politicians and say workers have no choice but to oppose cuts that have pushed unemployment to a 10-year high of 11.7% of the workforce in the first quarter. Affected were 8 scheduled sailings to the popular Cycladic Islands, which include Mykonos and Paros, and others to nearby destinations in the Argo-Saronic Gulf. A ferry to Crete was also canceled. Said Yanis Kouklis, 38, who works at a pharmaceutical company, "We are striking against the storm that is coming, the changes in pensions and labor laws which will turn workers into beggars. Labor action will intensify." A one-day general strike was due on June the 29th against pension and labor reforms due to be submitted to Parliament this week. The Eurobarometer poll taken in May showed that about 7 out of 10 Greeks expect their households' finances to worsen in the next year. And back to Toronto, residents in food deserts struggle to eat. Vanessa Liu, staff reporter at The Star. Tamara Sanchez plops lemons, blackberries, asparagus, avocados, and cucumbers on the folding table in the courtyard of her Toronto community housing complex. Cashier Asma Badoudi carefully weighs produce and tallies the bill on a calculator for Sanchez, who is doing part of her weekly shopping a stone's throw from home. "It's been amazing. These prices you can't beat, except maybe in Chinatown," said Sanchez. "The corner store is extremely overpriced, and it's not the quality of food we like." Because Sanchez doesn't drive, she needs to hop the streetcar or get a lift to a supermarket. Thanks to this weekly Good Food Market, run by volunteers affiliated with FoodShare, she has access to healthy food at reasonable prices. Not all Torontonians are so lucky. A new policy paper from the Martin Prosperity Institute analyzes the growing number of food deserts, areas where residents do not have easy access to food quality. A quick survey by The Star found For example, a 750-gram tub of yogurt costs $2.95 at No Frills, $3.99 at Loblaws, and $4.29 at Kitchen Table. Mark Denstead, a research associate at the Martin Prosperity Institute, notes that bulk buying or shared meal preparation in church basement are ways to ensure healthier food. Dr. David McCown, the city's medical officer of health, believes the time is right for initiatives such as farmers markets, community bake ovens, and local production. For Debbie Field, executive director of FoodShare, the solution is in better planning. As a right of living in a great city like ours, people should be able to walk two blocks from their home and get a full range of foods, fresh meat, vegetables, bakeries that are not outrageously priced. The Metcalf Foundation report recommendations are to set up a school food program, including food literacy in the curriculum. Support community food centers offering meals and supplies and teach healthy eating habits. Boost urban agriculture by making space available for growing and processing on city land. Expand purchasing by public institutions of local, sustainably produced food. Develop ways to help farmers grow organic produce or do on-farm processing to sell their goods. Plan for the future of food production through zoning and tax issues. And in a related issue, also from the Star, Laurie Monsabratin, social justice reporter, bold vision urged for welfare reform. Ontario panel says broken system needs overhaul to include new supports for low-income residents. Says a government-appointed panel in a report released Monday, we are currently investing billions into federal and provincial programs that too often trap people in poverty and fail to offer alternatives to social assistance. Gail Nyberg of the Daily Bread Food Bank chaired the panel of anti-poverty experts. Social Services Minister Madeleine Meyer appointed the panel last December to advise the government on the scope and terms of reference for a review of social assistance promised in 2008 as part of the Liberals' anti-poverty strategy. Nyberg acknowledged the panel is recommending a broader vision for welfare reform than the recession-ravaged Liberals may be prepared to consider. Ontario's current pre-retirement income security system provides about $26 billion in support, including child benefits, employment insurance, and tax credits. Social assistance, which includes Ontario Works and the Ontario Disability Support Program, accounts for just one-fifth, or $6 billion, of the $26 billion in support. Ideas the review should consider include a universal housing benefit for all low-income Ontarians, a short-term non-contributory unemployment income program for the 62% of Ontario workers who aren't covered by federal EI, a beefed-up education and training system for the longer-term unemployed, a more generous and less intrusive program for the disabled, similar to federal seniors' benefits. The panel's recommended 12 to 18-month review means significant reform is unlikely before the next provincial election in the fall of 2011. Meyer has acted on just 4 of 13 short-term welfare rule changes the paper recommended in January. And in a related column by Joe Fiorito in The Star, waiting for answers on Al Gosling's death. The report of the inquiry into Al Gosling's eviction from his bachelor apartment in community housing has been finally released. Al died last Thanksgiving weekend. The report, prepared by Patrick Lesage, a former Chief Justice of the Ontario Superior Court, took time. TCHC received it at the end of May. It will be the chief item on the agenda of the monthly TCHC board meeting at the end of June. Keiko Nakamura, the head of the corporation, would not give me a copy when I spoke to her Wednesday, nor would she say why she would not give me a copy, nor in the end was she long on specifics about what the report contained. After asking questions for the best part of an hour, I cannot tell you what specific lessons were learned or how anything will actually change. When Al Gosling neglected last year to sign his annual declaration of income, that's the document that entitled him to a rent subsidy, his rent was jacked up to market levels. Al was 82 years old. He had no secret source of cash. He wasn't working under the table. And, of course, arrears built up. Al ignored the form letters in his mail. He figured TCHC knew all they needed to know because nothing in his life had changed. Eventually, TCHC got an eviction order, and Al was summoned to appear before the landlord and tenant board. He did not appear. He came home one day and found the lock on his door had been changed. He slept by the stairs in his building for a week. Al, now hungry, frail, and dehydrated, was taken to a hospital by the police. From there, he was sent to a shelter. While in the shelter, Al picked up an infection, and he was too weak to fight it off. He ended up in a clinic on Sherburn Avenue. When TCHC was alerted, I remain appalled that they had to be alerted, they offered Al his old room back. They said it was always their intention to rehouse Al. If that was the case, why kick him out? To teach him a lesson? TCHC already has a perfectly progressive eviction prevention policy. Perhaps the Lesage report will tell TCHC how it ought to implement its own policies. The thing Ms. Nakamura said her staff would do differently, I don't exactly know. She wouldn't exactly tell me. I attended several of the meetings Patrick Lesage held with tenants about eviction. He's a fair and honest man who was plainly moved by what he heard. I saw his face when I handed him a sheaf of papers drawn by school kids who'd read the story of Al Gosling in their classrooms. There's never been anything in TCHC's mandate preventing staff, from cleaners all the way up to the highest office, from doing what would have saved Al's life last year. Making a phone call, saying hello, knocking on his door and asking how he was. Or finally, simple human decency, refusing to kick an 82-year-old man into the street. I wish I could tell you exactly what Lesage told the TCHC. You'll have to wait. Al waited. And from the Globe and Mail, Kelly Grant, City Hall Bureau Chief. Auditor questions value of controversial shelter. Buying the old Fez Batik nightclub and transforming it into a 40-bed shelter and assessment center was supposed to take 1 year and cost $5.5 million. Today, the project is 2 years behind schedule at twice the price. According to a scathing report by the city's Auditor General, Jeff Griffiths, council is to blame for about $1 million of extra costs. Mr. Griffiths pins the bulk of the blame on two city departments, the Shelter Support and Housing Administration, which had ordered 90 different changes to the project as of February 28, 2010, tweaks that accounted for $2.6 million of the cost overrun. The report says, quite frankly, it is our view that neither DCAP nor SSHA were aware of the city policy. Toronto's finance department is supposed to evaluate cost changes before the lease agreement is drafted. The Auditor General concludes that it wasn't clear who was in charge. For example, SSHA favored installing a first floor room for disabled clients rather than an elevator. DCAP argued correctly that the shelter needed an elevator to satisfy the city's accessibility design guidelines. The elevator was removed from the design anyway. In 2009, the bureaucrats overseeing the renovation concluded they needed the elevator after all. They asked council for an extra $500,000, $300,000 more than the architect originally estimated, because the elevator was added to the project so late. The Auditor General makes 14 recommendations to prevent future problems, most of which the city plans to follow. Could we have done things better? Absolutely, said Phil Brown, General Manager of Toronto's Shelter Support and Housing Administration. Take some time out with me now with pianist Henry Gray and Henry's House Rocker. Thank you. Toronto Star. Officials defend transplanting smokers' lungs to woman. The family of a 28-year-old British woman who unknowingly received a lung transplant from a smoker says she would have been horrified and have lodged a complaint. Cystic fibrosis sufferer Lindsay Scott in February 2009 received a double lung transplant from a donor who had smoked for 3 decades. She died in July of pneumonia. Britain's top transplant official, Chris Rudge, defended the decision and said patients should be told they are not getting a brand new organ. Scott's family called for patients to be told more information about organ donors before accepting a transplant. This from Stephen Drake of Not Dead Yet, new guidelines for determining brain death, but will hospitals actually follow them? In USA Today, when is someone brain dead? Experts revise guidelines. As a footnote, this is relevant to Canada, where doctors have the right to declare brain death despite assurances to the contrary. The American Academy of Neurology has issued new guidelines, an update of guidelines first written 15 years ago, that call on doctors to conduct a lengthy examination, including following a step-by-step checklist of some 25 tests and criteria that must be met before a person can be considered brain dead. According to the U.S. Uniform Determination of Death Act, a brain death occurs when a person permanently stops breathing, the heart stops beating, and all functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem, cease. The goal of the guidelines is to remove some of the guesswork and variability among doctors in their procedure for declaring brain death, which previous research has found to be a problem. But here's a relevant excerpt from the abstract of the study. In accordance with the Uniform Determination of Death Act, guidelines for brain death determination are developed at an institutional level, potentially leading to variability of practice. So unless I'm missing something, individual hospitals still get to set their own practice standards in making a determination of brain death. One of the authors seems to be engaging in a bit of denial over what the widely varying practices have meant in life and death terms. We found no credible report of anyone who was brain dead and who woke up and survived. I have two issues with this statement. First of all, any individual who's being evaluated for brain death is obviously in dire straits. It's highly unlikely that many would survive the removal of life support, even if they were capable of recovery. And obviously those who might have gotten falsely diagnosed as brain dead, who were organ donors, had no chance to recover at all. Which brings me to the second issue. In 2008, 21-year-old Zach Dunlap was determined to be brain dead in an Oklahoma hospital following an ATV accident. As luck would have it, one of the two friends who accompanied him to be prepped for organ donation had some medical training and got a feeling that Dunlap didn't look ready. The friend did some simple tests for reactions to scraping his skin and got them. Organ harvesting was called off and he eventually made close to a full recovery. The report on Dunlap was very credible. Maybe the report's authors would claim that Dunlap was never really brain dead, so he doesn't count. That would be beside the point, though, because no matter how thoroughly or sloppily the determination was made, once Zach Dunlap was declared brain dead, he was a corpse in the eyes of the state of Oklahoma, and he stayed a corpse until the hospital realized it made a mistake, although they called it a miracle rather than a mistake. So someone tell me, please, what good are the new guidelines if hospitals don't have to follow them? And in a follow-up from last week, Globe and Mail, Tuesday, June 29th, Pharmaceuticals Beef Up Prescription Drug Rules, Inquest Urges, by Adrian Morrow. The inquest into the suicide of 18-year-old Sarah Carlin, whose family believes she became depressed after taking the prescription drug Paxil for anxiety, delivered its verdict in Toronto Monday, along with a list of sweeping recommendations for changing the way medications are prescribed and regulated in Canada. The inquest ruled that depression, cocaine, and alcohol had affected Ms. Carlin at the time of her death, but stopped short of adding Paxil to those medications mentioned, leaving the drugs role in her suicide ambiguous. Ms. Carlin's family said the jury simply avoided assigning blame, which was beyond the inquest's purview. and argued the fact that jurors recommended such an overhaul of prescription drug regulations was proof they were convinced Paxil was responsible. The most ambitious of the inquest's 16 recommendations is that the federal government create an arm's-length body called the Drug Safety Board to investigate the side effects of prescription drugs, issue warnings to the public, doctors, and hospitals. The inquest specifically recommended the new board not receive any funding from drug companies. The inquest also recommended that drug companies be compelled to report all adverse reactions from all jurisdictions to Health Canada within 30 days, that doctors be given clearer warnings on the serious side effects of drugs, that similar information be available to patients at pharmacies, and that doctors be compelled to more thoroughly explain these side effects to patients, and that the province create a suicide prevention strategy. While experts argued that there was no evidence that Paxil caused Ms. Carlin's suicide, her family and its lawyer, Gary Will, maintained she became increasingly depressed after being prescribed the drug in February 2006. The University of Western Ontario student hanged herself in the basement of her parents' home in Oakville in May 2007. And we'll bookend the show this week with a little what passes for humor in politics. Another column by Jim Coyle. Mike Harris, Forever the Unforgiven. This space, possibly for the first time ever, said something halfway supportive of former Premier Mike Harris, vis-a-vis his receipt of an honorary degree. And we're telling Tim Hudak that readers reacted as if we'd spoken up on behalf of Satan himself. Peter from Oakville said, "Your old boss, Tim, was mean-spirited, and his modus operandi was cynical, divisive, and adversarial." Murray B. said the former premier should be wrapping up his first decade behind bars for his unconscionable destruction of Ontario society. Anne from Harris' old riding of Nipissing said folks there were initially proud of a local boy who made good, but that turned into a legacy of disappointment and outrage once the impact of his common-sense revolution agenda became apparent. Victoria B. was a teacher who remembers Harris' assault on her profession the way others remember where they were when they heard John F. Kennedy had been assassinated in Dallas, or Princess Diana had died in that tunnel in Paris. Dale S. of Bowmanville is a retired teacher who was most offended by Harris' misadventures in the school system. "For many in this province, we have long memories and no residual love for Mike Harris," he said. Ed K. of Hanover figured Nipissing U would next year be giving an honorary degree, posthumously, to Saddam Hussein. Allison G. said Harris's bullying tactics and haughty arrogance will never be forgotten. Barb M. said Harris is still a despised person in this province. John W. said Harris will be remembered for Dudley George and Walkerton and giving us John Snowblin to tear apart public education. "He did things which should never be forgotten and never be forgiven. Tim, all in all, we're thinking you might want to lose Mike H.'s phone number." And I guess that's what they mean when they say objects in the mirror may be closer than they appear. That's it for Disrespect for this week. Come back next week. We will have more. Going out, we have Memphis Slim and the Rolling Boogie. Thank you. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.